Hello, welcome to episode 40 of the Pop Culture Corumdale podcast. I'm Jeff Wright, one of your regular hosts, and I'm joined, as per usual, with Jared Moore, the other, the partner in crime on this enterprise we call the Pop Culture Corumdale podcast. Jared, buddy, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, man. I have had a pretty good day. I had a good birthday this week. I am 38 years of age and had a good life, man. Long life. Doing well. How you doing?
I'm doing well. So happy birthday to you. You don't look a day over 45, man.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that, actually.
No, I'm just messing with you. I'm glad you made another safe orbit around the sun, my friend.
Yeah.
How did you celebrate?
I laid around. I watched Christmas Vacation, Home Alone, ate cookies and vegetable soup.
Wait. Cookies and vegetable soup? Were you like trying to counterbalance the two?
Vegetable soup is bad too, man.
But oh, is it really?
Yeah. I mean,
thank you for letting me know, because I've always been morally opposed to vegetables, so it's good to know.
Vegetable soup is delicious.
Huh. Is that one of your favorite items?
It really is, yeah.
Okay. Things I did not know. Well, that's cool. Okay, anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just thought that was a curious combination. So you ate vegetable soup and cookies, and you said you watched Christmas Vacation
and Home Alone 1 and 2.
For real. Dude, there's so many times in my life that I've thought, like, Jared and I are mind-melded on important subjects, but Christmas movies, we could not be further apart.
Dude, Christmas Vacation may be the funniest movie of all time.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny, and I wouldn't object to watching that one out of season, but Home Alone, man, gosh, that's grating.
Are you kidding me?
Dude, it's hard for me to take.
It is so wonderful.
Oy. Cool. Cool story. I'm just not with you, but it's your birthday, buddy, and I want you to be happy, so happy birthday. Congratulations on your soup, your cookies, and your movies. Well, with that kind of handled, you want to get into our first section?
Yes, sir.
All right, man, I got all kinds of stuff for this one. So, listener, if this is new to you, we first start off the podcast by talking about the things we have been paying attention to since our last episode in a little segment we like to call
What You Watching? What You Watching? What You Watching?
All right, Jared, what you watching nowadays?
Let's see. Christmas Vacation, Home Alone 1 and 2.
Is that all you watch? Because I'm already sad if that's all you've watched this since we recorded last.
That and Gold Rush.
Oh, yeah, you already told us about Gold Rush. You got to get some new blood in there.
I'll tell you a secret of a show that Amber and I really watch and really laugh our heads off at. But it's got crude stuff every now and then, but most of it's just pure stupidity, is Impractical Jokers.
Okay, what's this about? I'm not familiar.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me, Jeff. You and Christy need to watch it. It's on True TV. It's four guys, like me, you, Terry, and Kevin, or Kenny. And all they do is do jokes on each other. Like it's like a hidden camera show.
Is this just the stuff Johnny Knoxville was doing back in the early 2000s rehashed? Is it?
No, it's a lot cleaner.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it's guys like, I don't know, they do skits where, like, it's just stupid stuff. It's hard to explain. But they set it up in like a grocery store, and you've got to go up and clip a balloon on somebody from behind them. And if whoever gets the most balloons on a person without them knowing wins.
Huh.
And then at the very end, if you lost that day of challenges, the other guys get to humiliate you. And so you have to do something that is humiliating. One of them was they heckled they forced the guy to heckle. I think it was at like a environmental thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's heckling the whole time, and dude, people are ready to drag him out and beat him to death at the end of it. But he has to stay in there and do it. At one punishment, the guy was at a baseball game getting autographs, and there were a bunch of people trying to get autographs. And so when they would throw the ball to the baseball player, he would sign it and throw it back, and the guy would get in front of the kids and catch it and stuff it. And they, boy, there was a mama that about killed him. It's just funny. I just think it's hilarious. But
it's just lighthearted, turn your brain off and have a good laugh kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's therapeutic to laugh. And so, like, if I watch a scary movie, dude, and go to sleep, it's usually not good. So I'll watch a scary movie sometimes, and then, for 30 minutes, I'll put on an episode of that or The Office or something just to laugh and get that craziness out of my head.
Yeah.
But dude, I think you and Christy would enjoy that show because
I appreciate you saying that. It's hard for me to communicate to you the way that I can already hear the sarcasm dripping off of her tongue about how foolish my entertainment choices are. I think I would enjoy watching that with you, and I think that's the way I need to experience this.
Maybe, man, maybe. But put a couple in front of her and just see. It's called Impractical Jokers. There's like 6 seasons, man. They got like 24 episodes each season.
Okay, I will check it out on your recommendation. Speaking of on your recommendation, so I watched Abducted in Plain Sight. I don't know how to like talk about this without spoiling a bunch of stuff. And so, listener, if you haven't seen Abducted in Plain Sight, a documentary on Netflix, tread carefully because we may inadvertently spoil some of it for you. There were 3 successive points in that documentary where I thought, that's the craziest thing I have ever seen in my life. And then you come back around and then like the next thing is even crazier.
Yep.
Right before we hit record on this podcast, a friend of the podcast, John, we call him John B at our church, but his name's John Bradley. He tweeted, "Abducted in Plain Sight is buck wild. These two people may be the most incompetent parents ever."
Yes, exactly. Yes.
We talked about this off air closer to when I actually watched the thing. And I told you, and I guess I mean this actually. I think that guy abused 6 children, right? Is what we heard at the end of the documentary.
Yeah.
There are 6 guys out there who missed their calling as parents to basically behead that joker and stick his head up on a pike in their front yard and dare a jury to tell them they did something wrong.
It's awful, man. I mean, just the whole thing is crazy. I mean, I wonder if the dude was like a genius or something, or just the whole thing that he came up with to even. I just never heard of a. You hear stories of pedophiles and how they manipulate the children and how they manipulate the parents, but I've never ever heard of anyone starting a relationship with both parents in order to get closer to the kid.
Yeah.
Like, and then it was almost like he had a hold over them and blackmail. And when that guy went in and they dropped all the charges, I think that was the worst part.
When the family signed away their prosecutorial perspective? Yeah, for sure. And I don't want to beat up on that family. You can tell that they really have carried the weight of the choices they've made. Mm-hmm. But it's a classic example of sin begetting sin. You know, these people were morally compromised, and it led them to have an inability to protect their daughter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And something else that's crazy, dude, is that they were a very conservative family, like morally, at least they seem like it.
Yeah, I think they were Mormon.
Yeah, and I mean, they had a high view of marriage, at least. I don't know. I don't think they were devout Mormon at first. Maybe they were later.
I don't think they were doing much of anything with seriousness except for trying to hide their shame.
Even the mother talking about her relationship with the man it made me uncomfortable, just even though it had happened 20 or 30 years earlier.
Yeah.
The way that she was describing it was just like, if I was her husband and watching that video, I'd be like, you still got feelings for this dude, you know?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I hate to even speculate about that. I really think that old boy, the dad, should have hopped in the car and drove down to Provo or Salt Lake or wherever he was living and just hit him with a brick coming out of his trailer or something. I mean, like that, you know, the justice system failed you. You failed your family. At some point, you got to regain control of the situation, and that predator was playing them like a piano.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. It was crazy, man.
Yeah,
straight up crazy. But yeah, like listeners, I still think you need to watch it. I think it's worth watching. But it will dumbfound you, and you'll wonder if you're watching a spoof a few times.
Well, and just as a warning to our listeners, Jared says you need to watch it. I think it probably will increase your understanding of how broken the world is. But there is some deeply sick stuff. I mean, the abuse the man perpetrated against the girl made my stomach turn, quite literally. And so if you're going to watch it, be prepared. You're going to get into some of the most awful stuff in human wickedness.
Mm-hmm.
More positively, have you heard of this documentary called Horror Noir?
Where did I see that? What's it on?
It's on Shudder.
Okay, I've heard of that, but maybe it's from you or another friend, Jody.
Yeah. Okay. So it I watched it. It came out, I don't know, I guess early last week, and I caught it. It is really fascinating. It's a look at the black community's relationship to horror movies as a genre.
Uh-huh.
And it's just stuff that I never heard of, never thought about, would have never considered had I not watched the documentary. And I do think at the end of the movie, it gets into a political perspective that I'm not on board with. So I've got a small quibble with it there. But on the whole, that thing was fascinating. And if you're one of our listeners who's into horror, I think it's potentially, anyway, it may not be true for you, but potentially maybe a real eye opener about a whole slice of horror that if you're anything like me, anyway, I realize that I knew much less about than I thought I did. Hmm. So I'll give you an example. There's a movie in the blaxploitation era called Blackula,
mm-hmm.
which I would have assumed was something that the black community would not have been excited about because it played on certain stereotypes. And again, the genre itself says this is exploitative, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it was really interesting to see black actors and creators saying how much they felt empowered by seeing that character on screen. And simple stuff that I would take for granted, like the character is very articulate. He's well-spoken and sophisticated. And they were saying that, like, they want to grow up and be him because they had just never seen that kind of representation on a movie before.
Hmm.
And it was just kind of jarring to hear some of it, actually. So, anyway, if anybody is looking for a good documentary to chase down after you swim through the sewer of Abducted in Plain Sight, I think Horror Noir is worth checking out.
Do you ever watch that Burning thing?
The Fire Festival?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I haven't got to it yet. I'm going to. I have watched a ton of stuff since we last talked, and I hadn't made my way there. I'm hoping to watch that one with the wife.
Yeah, okay.
We did watch we watched a movie together, Jared. That was quite fun. I got to watch it with you. I got to watch it with my friend Derek Zhu.
Oh yeah,
our mutual friend Derek Zhu, I should say. Our mutual friend Jody Webster and my wife Christy. It was The Prodigy, a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
We won't do a full review here, but could you give me your cliff notes on The Prodigy? What'd you think about that one?
I didn't care for it, really.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I did think it had a few good jump scares, and I mean, it had a lot of plot holes.
Yeah. So the main actor, I guess, the best actor is actually the youngest one. He's the kid who played Georgie in the 2017 adaptation of Stephen King's It. And I would have to say that out of everybody on the screen, he did the best job, which I'm not trying to belittle his performance. I thought it was really good, but it does say something about the rest of the cast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I knew you had forgotten about that one particular jump scare.
Uh-huh.
And when I knew it was coming, I was sitting between you and my wife. And so I just tried to kind of squeeze back in the seat as far as I could and put you guys in my peripheral vision. Mm-hmm. And watch it happen to y'all. That's one of the most unique jump scares I think I've seen in a long time. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I did not see it coming at all, obviously, because about jumped out of the seat.
Well, I'm glad you got to have that experience. And it frustrates me that I didn't, because they put that in the stupid trailer. And when I saw it in the trailer, I jumped. And I just thought, man, how much better would it have been to have met that scene like you did, not knowing it was coming? I mean, it's why I have this pathological problem with watching trailers. They just give away so much good stuff in it.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
Well, all right. I've seen some more stuff, but I'm going to put a bow on this so we're not on the microphone for 3 hours tonight. Anything else you want to talk about under the heading of what you're watching?
No, I think that's it, man.
All right, brother. Well, we'll put a bow on it, and that will move us into...
So sorry to interrupt!
Jared, I've got just a couple things to put in front of you for So Sorry to Interrupt. Feel free to tell me anything you want to talk about. One of them is lighthearted, and one of them is definitely not lighthearted. So let's start with the funny stuff.
Okay.
Have you seen Will Smith's Genie for the Aladdin live adaptation yet?
I have not, man.
Okay, so we have to do this. You're obviously sitting at a computer. Pull up the run sheet for this episode and just scroll down till your eyes land on that big, blue, beautiful image right in the middle of the document. We'll wait.
Dude, he looks weird.
I think that's putting it mildly. Yeah, he looks... I mean, he just looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
The internet has had a lot of fun with this. My favorite meme is the one that's below it in the dock where Will Smith's face is swapped out for Jack Nicholson's in The Shining, and we see Shelley Duvall's reaction. I think she speaks for all of us.
That's great, man.
I saw another one where the genie was photoshopped into a steal from Avatar. And somebody said, hey, the Avatar sequel looks terrible.
That is awesome, man.
Yeah. I really, really and truly, Disney is a mega gajillion dollar company. How is there nobody in the company who sees this and has enough clout to just tell people, we got to go back to the drawing board? How does this get through?
I don't understand how Will Smith ends up. I mean, you know, you got Robin Williams, who, just looking back historically, man, was on another level in his prime.
Yeah.
I mean, I could understand maybe a Steve Carell or give somebody a shot who's at least had some amazing comedic movies, you know?
You're not a Bad Boys fan, Jared?
Will Smith, this is not the part for him, man. He's going to get roasted.
Yeah, he'll never live this one down. The thing I don't get is why, if you're going to do this, why not just go full CGI? Just make it look like the genie from the cartoon.
Yeah.
If this is the best you can come up with, it just boggles my mind that in an age of focus groups and like algorithms that tell you what to put out and what not to, this is what Disney trots out.
It's funny, man.
It's buck wild. Buck wild. Well, I guess that's all the time we can apply to that. On a much more serious note, Jared and I, a listener, are both pastors of congregations affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. And this most recent Sunday, which was the 9th of February, do I have my date right on that? The 10th of February.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty dark day for Southern Baptists. You want to give the listeners the details in case they don't know, Jared?
From what I understand, there over a 20-year period, there's been over 700 victims of sexual abuse in Southern Baptist churches that have come forward and that have been detailed in, I believe, three different articles from the Houston Chronicle.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I was reading Joe Carter's write-up on this on the Gospel Coalition, which is really good if anybody wants to do some more reading on the data of this. It's Joe Carter regularly releases these FAQs about issues in the culture, particularly if they have legal ramifications, that he publishes on the Gospel Coalition. And this one's easy to find. Joe Carter, SBC, abuse. Google will find that for you. But it also says that the San Antonio News Express was involved. I attributed this basically all to the Houston Chronicle, but I guess there were San Antonio reporters as well.
Okay. Yeah, I guess the main scandal is there was cover up, it seems. I mean, And not only that, but there were pastors and youth pastors and volunteers that were able to go on to other churches.
Yeah.
I mean, it's wicked. It's evil.
Heartbreaking, stomach churning, just every emotion, every negative emotion goes through your head, your heart, and your stomach when you read this.
I mean, church, the community of the church is supposed to be the safest place on earth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, there's a lot of ugliness here, but I have appreciated the way that SBC leadership has responded to this. You know, you've got J.D. Greer, Russell Moore, the interim president of the executive committee, which, listener, if you're not familiar with the Southern Baptist Convention, let me give you just a Cliff Notes version of our ecclesiology. The Southern Baptist Convention has no authority over any local Southern Baptist church, which is odd, I think, for some people to understand. The Southern Baptist Convention is a mechanism created by local churches for the purpose of funding local and international missions and theological education. So it's a top-down organization, or rather it's a bottom-up organization. So Southern Baptist churches send delegates to the annual meeting of the SBC, and that's actually the only time the SBC exists formally.
Mm-hmm. Three days
out of the year. When those delegates go back home, the SBC formally no longer exists, and its affairs are covered by the executive committee, which is this organization that is elected by the delegates to manage the affairs of the Southern Baptist Convention when the Southern Baptist Convention isn't meeting at the annual meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Was that confusing, Jared? Is there something you need to clarify there to help our listeners out?
No, I think you detailed it. I mean, it's confusing if you haven't grown up in this world, or the local churches are autonomous. And to even summarize more, we basically, the only reason we associate with one another, not the only reason, but the main reason, is that we have like-minded beliefs and we want to reach the world with the gospel. And so we come together to form these missions agencies and seminaries because we can do more together than we can on our own as individual churches.
Right. And so for instance, and by contrast, you know, the Pope can say whatever he wants to any local Roman Catholic diocese, and that diocese is under obligation to do what the Pope says. But the current SBC president, J.D. Greer, he can't meaningfully tell any local church anything. Right. I mean, he's supposed to represent us, but he has no ability to come in and tell me what to preach or tell my church what time to meet. That would just be scandalous. And any attempt to do that would be scandalous. And a local Southern Baptist church would laugh him off the property if he tried, basically.
Yeah, he literally has no say so whatsoever, other than appointing a committee that appoints the trustees. I mean, that's basically the job of the SBC president. He appoints a committee that appoints the trustees of our various entities.
Well, when you say various entities, we're not talking about, again, local churches. We're talking about Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, or Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, any other, I mean.
International Mission Board, North American Mission Board.
Right. So, you know, those things are populated by men and women from Southern Baptist churches. The trustees handle getting them installed. The president's relationship is to sort of make recommendations.
And we voted him in. Southern Baptist churches, as Jeff said, sent delegates, and they voted. So, in other words, the delegates will vote him out next year, vote on him again. Or the next time someone else runs, they'll vote on them. But it's the exact opposite. They don't, in the Catholic Church, they don't vote on the Pope every year, you know, or every other year. And he's literally, well, in the Catholic Church, he's the vicar of Christ, right?
Right. J.D. is not the vicar of Southern Baptists, let alone Christ.
That's right.
And so I mention all this to bring up the subject of the executive committee. So the executive committee is a big deal in Southern Baptist life because it handles a whole lot of stuff for most of the year on behalf of Southern Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I was thankful for the way J.D. responded, because he is the face of Southern Baptists, I guess, Russell mm-hmm. Moore. But then we have an interim executive committee president named Augie Bodo. And Augie is his nickname. I think his first name is August. I could be wrong on that, but he's pretty well known. He's Augie, and he's general counsel to the SBC and currently serving as the interim president. On February 9th, the Houston Chronicle published this interview with him, and I would encourage our listeners to go look this up if you're interested. The headline is "Investigation into Sexual Abuse, quote, shining the light of day upon crime, Southern Baptist leader says." And there's this really important exchange within the interview, and I'm going to read it to our listeners real quick so that we have it on the record to talk about it. So the Houston Chronicle reporter poses this question to Augie. He says, "Since the SBC does not keep stats, we went out and tried to quantify this problem. We found roughly 200 SBC ministers and volunteers and youth pastors who had been criminally convicted. We're going to be posting these records online in a searchable database in order for people to use it as a resource." And at that point, Bodo says, "Good." And it befuddles the interviewer in a good way, I think. So the interviewer says, "What's that?" And Bodo repeats himself. He says, "Good." And the interviewer says in response, "I guess I have to ask, that's not quite the response I expected. Why do you think that's good?" And Bodo goes on to say, "Because your posting of it's going to heighten awareness. It's going to harden the targets. I told you at the outset of this phone call that my perception of your doing a report is probably more positive than you would suspect. I think some people presuppose that our initial reaction to a report of Southern Baptist failure anywhere is embarrassment. I can assure you that is not my initial reaction. My initial reaction is anger." And he says, you know, anger at the sexual crimes that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on, and I think Augie really handles this well, but the last thing he says that I appreciate in the interview, or not the last thing I appreciate, but the last thing I want to mention, mm-hmm. is he says to these interviewers, "Guys, you are not my opponent. You are not the opponent of the Southern Baptist Convention in your reporting. You're helping us. I'm all for shining the light of day upon crime." And I just so appreciate that the leaders within the largest Protestant denomination in the world are not treating this as a public relations disaster to be managed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thankful Amen. For that.
Amen. I hope it. I think he's exactly right. I mean, that it is a good thing, and there will be churches that also implement procedures that help prevent this kind of thing from happening in their churches, which I think is good as well.
Yeah, I mean, Lord willing, that's one of the major fruits that will come from this, is that churches will be more aware and more, I don't want to say empowered, but more aggressive in setting up wise policies and holding to them to protect people mm-hmm. in their congregations.
Yeah, amen.
I've got some stuff I want to ask you about on this, but any perspective on this reporting that you want to highlight for us to get started here, Jared?
I think it, as far, not about the reporting, but how people use the information to either go after complementarianism or to go after Christians or to go after evangelicals or to go after, you know, fill in the blank, you know. I think that is it's a poor way to go. Like, let's start with the complementarian thing. Like, you hear this argument that the SBC has given a system where this type of thing can happen. And then you throw up your hands and you start asking the question. I mean, that's just a narrative that, well, I think it's baloney myself. Based on, if you look at the overall, how many people were in SBC churches in that 20-year time period, and the actual percentage that has come forward, and to act like this is a pandemic thing, it's just not the case. Now, one is too many.
For sure, 100%.
Yeah, we've got to prevent even one. We've got to bust our tails to make sure nothing like this ever happens again. But to say that it is systemic is baloney. The reason why I say that is because look at just the scandals in the past 2 or 3 years. Think of Bill Hybels' church. Bill Hybels, egalitarian, not even complementarian. And yet, male-female elders, and they covered up for him for years. Years. Think of Larry Nassar. Larry Nassar, who I believe was it Michigan State, Jeff, University?
Yeah, I believe so.
And so he molested young girls for decades. And you can't get more egalitarian than the boards on a college campus.
Sure.
And yet they covered up for him. They covered up for him year after year after year. And I mean, the list can go on and on. The issue is sin. This is not a systemic problem in the SBC.
You know, Jared, I am with you in that I don't think this is a product of complementarianism. I think complementarianism actually prompts men to protect women from just this kind of abuse, to protect yes. children from just this kind of abuse.
Yes, I totally agree.
I also don't think this is a product. I've seen it laid at the feet of purity culture. So programs like True Love Waits, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, you know, it's come into vogue to be very critical of purity culture. And I realize there are real problems with purity culture. But as someone who grew up in that, in the day when those things were, you know, being taught to students and young people, I think we have been told that there's more wrong with it than actually was. And, mm-hmm. and in some ways, I think it's kind of Paul's point. This came from a church member. We talked about at church night. We talked about this reporting from the Houston Chronicle on their Wednesday night service. And one of my church members made the point that, you know, this is akin to Paul saying the law is good. Now, the law provoked coveting within me, but the law is not the problem. My response to the law is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see a lot of credibility in the idea that this is a problem of purity culture, but here's where I think this is a systemic problem. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I submit this to your scrutiny. I really want to hear your thinking through this. We just talked at length about how each Southern Baptist congregation is autonomous.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that J.D. Greer is the president, or even Augie Bodo as the head of the executive committee. They can't come in and tell our church to do squat. Right.
Right.
Well, that applies to my church and its relationship to you, or excuse me, your church. Right. So
mm-hmm.
you're in a sistering community. We're through the SBC partnering for missions, but you couldn't come and tell me, hey, Jeff, you should fire this staff member. And I couldn't go to your church and say, you need to dismiss this deacon. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think that within autonomy, which is biblical, I can say that with confidence. I think local church autonomy is biblical. Within that, there is a loophole for predatory people to exploit the lack of communication between autonomous entities. And I think that it is uniquely our age that is guilty of allowing these kind of loopholes to exist. So here's what I mean by that. And again, this is where I want your criticism. Traditionally, Southern Baptists, if someone were going to leave my church and go to yours, when that person petitioned your church for membership, you would contact me and say, can you recommend this person to membership in our church? Mm-hmm. Or would you recommend that we not accept this person into membership, right?
Mm-hmm.
That process has virtually been eliminated by the attractional church model, where membership is minimized to merely regular attendance.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone away from a formal membership process where the individual covenants with the body. And in that process, the receiving body looks to the previous body of believers and says, help us understand the choice we're making here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a conversation with an attractional pastor one time where, you know, this is something my church still practices. We call it the church letter system, but it goes beyond a letter. Yes, there's some paperwork that's sent in the mail. But if I get somebody joining my church who's moving from another congregation, well, I call that pastor and I say, what led them to leave? Would we be serving the kingdom better by telling them to go back to church with you rather than receiving them into our congregation? So I had a conversation one time with an attractional church pastor who was saying, like, hey, I heard these people are attending your church. Is that so? They visited us for a while. We didn't know what happened to them. And I basically walked him through, like, this is why Baptists had the letter system and why they were serious about formal membership. And he looked at me like I had grown a third head.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that in throwing that away in the name of making it as easy as possible to get the biggest numbers possible, we've created a loophole for predators to feed upon the innocents in our congregations. I also think that evangelicalism, but Southern Baptists in particular, have been colonized by pragmatism that makes more people, bigger numbers, the end-all, be-all hope of church life. And what that does is put tremendous negative pressure on vetting the people who come in to join in the church, to join the church's work. In fact, we have these systems of, I think they call it belong before you belong, which is like, you know, we don't really know you, so why don't we get you involved in like certain low-level ministries of the church, like greeting people in the parking lot or working in these other areas. So we're actually putting people into positions to encounter church members and visitors in some sense as a representative of the congregation before we are even willing to say that like we know them well enough to bring them into membership, because it's an effective strategy for integrating people into our church, and more people in our church is the end-all be-all goal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that pragmatic concerns for increasing numbers have stretched this loophole even larger and said, yeah, we're not going to take the time to be careful about the front door of the church. And then the opposite is true as well. So I know I'm going at length here, but I really do want you to, I want you to take a shot at this and where you see a weakness. We also are terrible about guarding the back door of the church. And so, it's basically the idea of meaningful membership and meaningful membership built around church discipline. So if I'm in some huge attractional church, it's easy for me to show up on Sundays in a huge crowd, duck out. Nobody really know what's going on with me spiritually. And if I'm not saying that's necessary, I'm just saying it's symptomatic of large attractional churches that are not careful to cultivate meaningful membership structures. And maybe you say, well, then we're going to get them into a small group. But the small group training that I have looked into in some of our neighboring attractional churches that are pretty big is pretty simplistic as well. Basically, if you are willing to host a group and you live in the same area, there's a lot of churches who will make you a small group house leader. And again, not pastoral oversight. It's just you're in this small group ecosystem, and you could be very disconnected from the oversight of the elders or whatever the leadership structure of the church is. I think this is another area where we've opened the door wider to people who can exploit that kind of lack of familiarity to do evil things. And then, so let's say something surfaces. There's an accusation, something awful happened. Jared, you just tell me, have you met more than three pastors who, if there was a scandal in their church, they would be tempted to handle it quietly so it didn't interrupt the perception of good things happening at the church?
Most of the guys I know and that I associate with are not the attractional kind.
Yeah.
And so I think all of them would handle it the right way, the ones that I know personally. So I may not be a good one to ask that question. But I understand it's that mentality goes on, like it's going to hurt the church. We don't want to hurt the church type thing.
And hurting the church is defined as, I mean, I hate to be so cut and dry about it. It's reputation. It's brand management.
Yeah.
We're the happening church. We're the church where the Lord's really moving. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't be affected by this. I know of churches that maybe not at this level, but have shuffled church members, church staff off to other opportunities for things that are unhealthy. And they don't want to deal with the scandal it could cause if this goes on further. And so rather than like dragging it into the light, they tell the person, you need to resign or you're going to be fired. And the church never knows.
Yeah, that's definitely unhealthy. When I was early in youth ministry, there was a girl that came in, teenage girl, came in. I never knew her. There were other people there in the church at the time, but it was an evening. I don't know if something was going on, but I was in my office, and she came in my office, and she told me that she had been raped. And I called the police and called her youth pastor, and I mean, they went and got her out of school the next day. And I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to report. You have to report, you know, crime that where folks have been hurt. Like it's, and in counseling, I've told teenagers, you know, beforehand when they wanted to talk to me that, you know, cause they, you know, if they're talking to you, they don't want you to tell anybody. But I let them know that I've got to tell. And, it's the responsible thing to do. And I mean, it's the biblical thing to do.
It's a non-negotiable.
Yeah. I mean, that God has given the governing authorities to help restrain evil and punish evildoers. And the church's responsibility is to share the gospel and win folks to Christ. We are not to, just like Augie said, we are not to hide crime. You know, that is not the church's responsibility.
Yeah, the church, I mean, Jesus brings these kind of hidden sins into the light.
Yeah, and let me just say this. People want to pull the woman in an adultery story into things like this. That's kind of the mentality. Well, look, Jesus said he did not condemn this woman and all this stuff. And I'm like, come on, guys. That's really your argument.
Making the connection. Can you help me out a little bit here?
As far as the church is not to report crime, you know, it's just like Jesus did not report that lady's adultery.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, those are the arguments that you hear.
That's horrifying. That's terrible.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the mentality. That's the, you know, almost like there's two kingdoms, you know, the church is its own entity. And I think it's an abuse of scripture because they totally ignore Romans 13. They totally ignore why God has set up governing authorities, what their purpose is, and the distinct purpose of the church versus the distinct purpose of the government. And I don't think both of these are appointed by God to do specific roles in this creation. And one day Christ will rule both.
Yeah, well, amen. I mean, he does rule both. He'll just do it visibly.
Right.
Well, so the two prongs of my argument are basically meaningful membership / church discipline. Mm-hmm. I think the pragmatic push of the attractional church model has marginalized if we were looking at this as a species, meaningful membership and church discipline is on the endangered species list within evangelical and Southern Baptist life. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem that I think fed this scandal and this cover up and all that. The other one is the resume system for identifying church leaders. Hmm. And listener, if your church is hiring or if you're ever in a church that's in a hiring process, let me encourage you as a brother in Christ, do not make use of a national database from which to gather resumes to hire your next pastor. So, Jared, again, I'm inviting you to criticize this. When I read Paul talking about the criteria by which we evaluate an elder, 1 Timothy, Titus, right? Mm-hmm. All those criteria assume you know this person thoroughly. You know not just his doctrine, but you know his family life. You know his character. You know stuff that cannot be communicated by a resume, and you know stuff that cannot be communicated through hand-picked references who will tell you, you know, all the good of this guy, but because they are handpicked by the person, are by definition less likely to tell you, here are the significant weaknesses you should watch out for. And so what mm-hmm. I would advocate for in Southern Baptist life, when we have a leadership transition, a healthy church will have young men or maybe older men who the Lord has raised up within the life of that body.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're saying, my church really doesn't do that, you need to push your church to start intentionally training, identifying and training the next generation of leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And if they grew up in your church and you know them, yeah, you're going to know their weaknesses, but you're also going to know if they meet the criteria of the pastoral epistles.
Mm-hmm.
That should be one candidate pool. Maybe you have versions of those guys who have gone on to serve other congregations. That's another candidate pool. Okay, we don't have either one of those. Who do you know? What relationships do you have with healthy ministers or other healthy congregations where they can recommend someone to you on the basis of their knowledge of that person's character and doctrine over a prolonged period of time?
Mm-hmm.
You may not get the next rock star evangelical leader. And I'm sorry if that's a problem for you, but you're going to get a leader who's much closer to the biblical criteria for evaluation. And I think the fact that we go out and hire people from thousands and thousands of miles away who have given us a very stylized presentation of themselves and cherry-picked people who say good things about them to give us references, we cannot be surprised when people use that lack of familiarity to shuffle from one hunting ground to another.
Hmm.
So that's it. Meaningful church membership and the way we identify and hire leaders seems to me to be the systemic issue in Southern Baptist life that has allowed this to happen. And the really terrible part of this is that we had better resources to prevent it that we threw away in the name of innovation and church growth.
Hmm.
So tell me what I'm overlooking there.
Well, I mean, we could argue semantics as far as systemic. I mean, this is something that is, I mean, exactly with the things that you described have been habitual in the SBC. I mean, I think our meaningful membership is increasing, not decreasing.
Well, praise the Lord. Let that be so.
Well, it's because of the seminaries. I think just in the seminaries and the dudes I know, I mean, I know it's being taught. It's just it's like turning a ship. And so I think that's turning around. And then the emphasis on raising up leaders, I think, is turning around. But as far as systemic, I guess you could see the people who provide the databases for the resumes. But again, you've got a ton of small congregations that don't have the leaders in them. I agree. I mean, that's what local associations are for. That's what other churches are for. I mean, I agree with that the recommended part. Like, if you don't have someone there, you need to contact someone you trust to recommend someone.
And specifically someone that can be known.
Sure.
Not somebody who's coming to South Carolina from California, you know, who's lived on the West Coast for 1,000% of their life. And the guy in South Carolina met them once at a conference. But, like, who do you know from your church body who might profit us, or who can mm-hmm. you recommend we call that you know would give a solid recommendation? Like, stay as local as possible. Only expand your net as far as you're required to.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that is so much. That is such a great guard against so many of the problems we see afflicting not just evangelicals, but specifically Southern Baptists in our day.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I agree with all those three points. I don't know. I mean, there is no perfect system, but I think that those things that you mentioned, if all those were in place, that it would potentially help these issues, help prevent these things from happening again. But There also needs to be procedures in place in addition to meaningful church membership, in addition to, you know, just like two people at a time. Like in our church, you know, men aren't allowed to take kids to the bathroom by themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's several things like that that would need to be in place, even if you do have all these other things.
You're absolutely right. I don't want to minimize having effective and wise policies for your children's department or anything that are structural. I think more churches are aware of that. I think we're less aware how throwing away meaningful membership and how we hire pastors or how we structure pastoral authority. Those are things I think that are more of a blind spot. That's why I majored on them. But I certainly affirm what you just said.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really have much pushback on. Okay. I mean, we agree on those. It's just, you can still have an elder board. There's always dangers, right? That you can still have an elder board that says, well, we need to. I mean, we've seen that. We've seen that in, I mean, think of the pastors that have fallen in the past 2 or 3 years where they supposedly had a plurality of elders.
James McDonald just today was fired.
Yeah. And they had, but
I mean, he was fired by the elders, though. I think that's the best version of this.
Yeah. Yeah. That or the congregation firing him. Yeah. But,
sorry. That's exactly right. It is better for the congregation. I just assumed that the elders were working on behalf of the congregation. If this were, if Harvest is elder governed, I would see that as less healthy. So,
yeah,
they
might be. I don't know. But all that's good discussion, man. I still don't know that I would call it systemic. But I don't know what else to call it. Because when I think of systemic, I think of top down systems in place type. But you've got all these folks that are voluntarily. What do you think? Do you think it was revivalism that brought this about, Jeff? Or
no, I think it's Schulerite, Warrenite ecclesiology, and the inheritors being like Andy Stanley, but also some of the stuff that you don't agree with me on this. I just want our listeners to hear it. This is just me saying, but some of the mess that's come out of Lifeway research about how to grow churches and whatnot. Mm-hmm. That's why I see it as systemic, because our institutions are telling us this is the right way to do it. And yet to try and make the argument that this is how you do it from scripture. I mean, it's like they didn't countenance the question. They just assume the Bible doesn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're all blown away when not paying attention to what the Bible said comes back to bite us.
Mm.
I'll also say one last word. You're familiar with the Billy Graham rule or the Mike Pence rule, right? Never be alone with a woman who's not your wife.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a rule that I practice to the degree that Mike Pence and Billy Graham practice. So I'm currently the only full-time staff member at my church. Our church secretary will be in the building with me sometimes when we're the only two in the building. Or if we have to run, if we're going to go to lunch across town.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just have her hop in the car with me and we'll drive over there. So I don't practice that, but something I have noticed in recent days, basically since Trump got elected, is that it's become cool among evangelicals to laugh at the Mike Pence rule.
Hmm.
And I think what's happened is, again, this is my read. You don't have to join me in this. I think people are embarrassed of Trump. They're embarrassed of Mike Pence being associated with him. And so it's become fun to laugh at the Mike Pence rule and the Billy Graham rule. And I'm saying that as somebody who doesn't practice it.
Mm-hmm.
But man, would the Billy Graham rule and the Mike Pence rule have protected a whole lot of people if it had been faithfully practiced. And so maybe we want to take just a minute and reconsider before we kind of dismiss that as something to be mocked.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't see how people could say it's unwise or foolish. I mean, even in the Me Too movement, and the Me Too movement has brought about a lot of good. I mean, the wicked do need to be exposed, but it has also brought an emphasis on always believe the accusation, and that should terrify. Like, I've got 3 sons. Raising them up in a world where every accusation is to be believed is scary, and not to mention for ministry, right? And ministering.
Yeah.
And so if you keep yourself from the hint of an accusation, I wouldn't call that unwise. I think that is a wise position to take, and I sure wouldn't laugh at it.
Well, I'm reading, Oh, what is the name of the book? I think it's On Reading Well by Karen Swallows Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good. It's right in my wheelhouse. It's all about literature and how to cultivate virtue through reading good stories.
Mm-hmm.
But just last night I was reading and she mentioned the Mike Pence rule or the Billy Graham rule. I can't remember which one she tied it to. But she says, you know, this creates discrimination and some other negative consequence. And I was just like, yeah, okay. If we're going to be weighing out in the balance, though, between what it protects against versus what it might inadvertently create, I think the scales swing in favor of practicing this if it's your conscience or if it's just like, hey, this is probably the most wise thing I could do. Because guess what? It is really super wise and it protects a lot against a lot of really bad stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's going to – I don't think it's going to create discrimination in local churches because, I mean, it's primarily, at least in Southern Baptist churches, it's primarily male leadership. But I could see how it could negatively impact because, I mean, you've got to – the people who are going to get to the top in the business world are those who are known. And if you're – but I don't know. I guess they could create scenarios where they – You got to be alone in order to really get to know someone, or got to be at least sitting across from someone having a conversation. But I mean, you could do that in a public place with, I don't know. I think that's what she's getting at, dude. That it negatively tips the scales towards men being around each other all the time in the corporate world, and women can't ever climb the ladder because men are in charge type thing.
Still, I mean, look, I know I'll probably get hate tweets for this. Still a better problem than men abusing women behind closed doors.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Still a better problem than men being falsely accused of abusing women behind closed doors. I'm not arguing with you so much as I am the person you're describing. I think that probably is the argument. I'm going to take the set of problems that we have resources to deal with over the set of problems that destroy lives.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell I feel strongly about this?
What now?
Can you tell I feel strongly about this?
Yes. You feel strongly about a lot of things.
Not me, man. I don't have strong opinions on anything.
I like that better. It's better than the wishy-washy mess, you know?
Yeah. All right, man. Anything else you want to say on this one?
I think the SBC's got some work to do, and I think it's sobering. And I think that a lot of abuse can be prevented, and I believe there will be abuse that is prevented because of this report. And so, yeah, I'm with Augie, man.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I'm glad that it happened, even though it's painful.
By it happened, you just mean the reporting, like, yeah.
Sorry. Yes, thank you for clarifying. I'm glad that the reporting happened.
Yeah.
And not to pull the Jesus card on you, but this is just a reminder that, you know, come Lord Jesus. Just come and end the wickedness. Mm-hmm. I know for the sake of the gospel, he's delaying, but, man, it'd be good to see him show up and wrap this phase of history up.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And it's... You know, hey, can we do a segue just briefly, Jeff?
Sure, man. You're a co-host. You do what you want, buddy.
Well, I am, because of things like this, like, I'm not letting my kids stay the night with anyone other than close family until they get old enough to fend for themselves. Like, I'm talking like 16. And I was just curious what you thought about that. Like, because my kids, I've got an 11-year-old. A 9-year-old. And so their friends are already starting to ask about having sleepovers and dude, I'm just not there. I don't think they'll lose anything by postponing those things. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. So, I'm with you, but that is a practice of our family, and we too have ran into it. The one exception we ever made was a group sleepover for some dear friends who are church members.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a major deal because, I mean, I love those people. I trust them enough to send my child over there, obviously, but I was so committed to the idea that my family won't do sleepovers. The statistics on sleepovers are pretty terrifying. And I mean, as a kid, there's nothing I enjoyed more than going to spend the night at my friend's house. And thanks be to God, nothing untoward ever happened. But we're pretty aggressive. I say aggressive. We're pretty dogmatic about this. And I don't think even at 16, because I mean, 16 is an age where they are wiser, but they're also subject to manipulation in different ways at that age. I don't think my kids will ever, if I can, you know, if it depends on me and my wife, my kids won't stay the night at someone's house who isn't, like you said, a close family member. I mean, my kids could stay the night with you or our buddy Terry Felton. Like there's a list of people that I have known.
Sure.
In such a way that they're almost like family, but mm-hmm. that's a short list. And, you know, I'm assuming I'm going to offend people over this, but I'm pretty committed to the principle. Again, as a guy who doesn't have strong opinions about anything, I feel pretty strongly about this one.
Yeah, the almost every immoral thing that I was exposed to as a child, you know, eighth grade and under, happened at sleepovers.
Yeah, yeah. I remember at a sleepover at my house, a mutual friend of ours spent the whole night trying to figure out how to unlock pornography on our satellite television system.
Yeah, I mean, I could give you a list of vices that I was exposed to early, and things that probably negatively, things that honestly that probably warped me. You know, I mean, God, you know, God heals. But things that, you know, I'm going to postpone that until my kids, the potential for it, just postpone it until my kids can be wise and make wiser decisions and, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to postpone it until they're beyond my legal control or they're spending the night with their best friend who is their spouse.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's probably some product of purity culture that is faux pas right now, but as for me and my house, this is how we will attempt to serve the Lord.
Well, what I'm doing, though, is like, hey, you can stay till 10 o'clock at night and I'll come pick you up, like type thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're trying to put reasonable checks on it. Yeah.
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 But anyway.
All right. Well, we will wrap that up and get to actually what pays the bills around here. Not that there's actually any money being made here, but it is time to pull the curtain on Netflix's High Flying Bird. You ready to get into this, Jared?
Yes, sir.
All right, man. So we're going to do the Pop Culture Coram Deo thing. We're going to look at this story in comparison to the story God is telling about his son Jesus through history. And God is telling the story of Jesus in four acts: creation, fall, redemption, and glorification. God created the world good. He watched as creation chose the path of rebellion and brought suffering and death. But he's committed to his purposes. And so his faithful son, who is also his faithful servant, comes as the agent of redemption, suffers on behalf of those who believe in Christ, and he gives a righteousness to them. He dies under the wrath of God against their sin, rises triumphantly from the grave, ascends to sit at the right hand of the Father to reign over all things. And he's, you know, in his ruling, creating this better world, this glorified world. And so we look at the stories that we examine here on the podcast in those categories and see how accurately they reflect the story God's telling again about his precious son, Jesus. And with that in mind, Jared, in the world of High Flying Bird, we've got a lot to talk about. Let's start with the summary. Then we'll get to conscience warning and dive right into our analysis. Okay.
Sure.
So here's the IMDb summary. A sports agent pitches a rookie basketball client on an intriguing and controversial business opportunity during a lockout. And this is sort of set in the world of the NBA. It apparently is based on the 2011 lockout that actually occurred in the NBA. Anything you'd add to that summary?
No, that sounds good, man.
All right. Anything you would highlight in conscience warning?
Mainly language.
There is quite a bit of foul language, no doubt. No nudity in this one, right?
I don't believe so. I don't remember anything.
Yeah, there's none that I saw. There is strongly implied at one point that a young woman and a young man have had casual sex, and they go on to reference it, and it's kind of a casual subject, right? They treat this as if it's no big deal. But again, everybody, you know, we see everybody clothed and nothing pornographic or sexualized is happening in front of our eyes anyway. It's just alluded to. I would also say there's some really ungodly economics in this one. So I'm saying it kind of jokingly, but I think that's a matter of righteousness to understand how God has ordered his world. And that's in here, but we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into our analysis. Jared, do you watch many Steven Soderbergh films?
I don't know. What else has he done?
He has done some stuff that I know you haven't seen. I think he made his name by through a movie called Sex, Lies, and Videotapes. Or Sex, Lies, and Videotape back in the late 80s. But he has done, let's see, Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12. Aaron Brockovich.
Saw Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12. Never saw Aaron Brockovich.
Yeah, I know you did not see Magic Mike, but that's him as well. what else? He did Logan Lucky, which was sort of a niche thing. He also did a movie in 2018 called Unsane.
Okay. I've heard good and bad about that. People either love it or hate it.
Well, I'm definitely in the hate it camp. It's terrible. There's a plot hole in it big enough to drive a truck through. But the thing about Soderbergh is that this is a guy with real Hollywood chops. And for Unsane and for High Flying Bird, he shot the movie entirely on an iPhone 8.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that for High Flying Bird. I did think it was odd.
Well, he did it with Unsane, I think, for the first time. And you can tell that movie looks super weird. And it does not add to the effect. But in High Flying Bird, he's made some changes where this thing looks like, a high-end visual presentation.
Uh-huh.
And there's a piece on IndieWire that if anybody's into this side of filmmaking, I would recommend you go track down. It's by Chris O'Fault. He published it on February 12th of this year. And the title is High Flying Bird, What Soderbergh Begged Apple to Change About the iPhone. And so he just goes into the details of why he chose the smartphone. And it's really interesting. He said that's basically he wanted the size of the iPhone because it gave him a chance to get into really tight quarters. And like in Unsane, he did some stuff where like if he needed it to be really close to the actress's face while she's staring at a door or something, he would just tape the iPhone to the wall.
Oh, wow.
And like in that same piece, he talks about a scene where the young man playing the basketball player and the young lady that's his, somehow connected to his agent, they're going down a hallway. And the tracking shot would have just been impossible to safely get if he'd been using a big rigged camera that weighed like 350 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So he sat down in a wheelchair, held it up with his arm, and had someone pull him back at a uniform pace. And it looks like this really great tracking shot.
Hmm.
So, yeah, if you're into the way movies are made, it's a pretty interesting piece and an interesting decision on his part. He says that Apple wants people to start doing this, that like this is one of the things they want to sell the iPhone as holding the potential of.
Wow.
Yeah.
We need to make a movie, dude, you and I.
Well, we got to buy an iPhone 8 first. It's like $800.
Yeah, but you can put it on a whatever plan thing for 2 years and, you know, pay for it.
Can I do that on your account?
Yes. My name is...
Terry Felton.
No, yeah, that's right.
We love you, Terry. And listener, tune in to the next Sports Quorum Deo that Terry Felton and I will do at the end of this month. All right, Jared. So that's the only other item I had for kind of show notes. You want to get into this thing?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so what do you see as creational goodness in the world of High Flying Bird?
People using their talents, I wouldn't say for the glory of God, but it is good to see people using their talents to make money, or, well, they're not able to make money, right?
Not enough of it, I think, or like not a high enough percentage of it.
Right. I don't know. I don't. What is the creational goodness in this movie to you, dude?
I think that just the possibility of athletics as a vocation is part of, you know.
We're really reaching, aren't we?
Well, I actually think it's legitimate. I think it's assumed here. This movie is not trying to present it as like something great about the world. The other thing that's good here is community. You know, there's this local gym and this guy teaches players there at the gym, and then like people who have made it come back and support that work. That's good. That's good.
Yeah, that is good.
But the vision of what's good in this world is really reduced because it wants you to see it as a Darwinistic competition between competing interests.
Mm-hmm.
So the only good that's available is for the athlete to maximize his economic power over and against the owners of the teams. And so it is mm-hmm. hard to talk much about anything that's high-level good in this one. What about fallenness?
Fallenness happens when they're not able to maximize their earning potential, I guess.
Yeah, specifically over and against the owners of the sports team.
Mm-hmm.
So the competition isn't, it isn't like the NBA versus the NFL. It's the athlete versus the owner of their team. And you know, you get this impression that maybe there's some competition between the athletes, but that ultimately just goes to serve the competition between the athlete and the ownership. So
yeah,
it really is fighting the power structures of NBA ownership. What would you say is redemption in High Flying Bird?
If fall is not being able to earn, then I guess sticking it to the man, right? Sticking it to the owners.
Very much so. There's a scene where the agent, who is played quite masterfully by Andre, I think I butchered that pronunciation. It's Andre Holland, who you may remember from Hulu's Castle Rock series.
Yeah.
He's great in this, and he is playing ball at the community gym owned by Bill Duke's character, Spence. And he tells Andre Holland's character, Ray, tells Spence, "I just want to take the game out of their hands for a while." And Spence says, how do you remind a man that he's a man? And they say something like, "Remind him that he's mortal." And so the idea is to fire a shot across the bow of the NBA ownership structure so they would remember that they're not the end-all be-all.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's telling that there's a Bible in this movie. Do you remember what that Bible motif was? Did you pay attention to that?
No, huh?
So we first open up the movie with Andre Holland's Ray Burke, who's an agent, meeting with Melvin Gregg's Eric Scott, who is this hotshot rookie who's waiting for the league to resume so he can get paid. His name's Eric Scott, the character. And I think he's supposed to be Ben Simmons from the Philadelphia 76ers because they make a big deal about how he was at LSU, which is where Simmons came from. So they're talking back and forth, and Andre's kind of educating him to the way the people are going to prey upon him as an athlete. And, you know, he hands him this manila envelope, and he says, Eric Scott says, "What's in this?" And Ray Burke says back to him, "The Bible." Eric says, "When should I read it?" And Andre's character says, "You'll know when the time is right." And then like halfway through the movie, it comes up again. The guy brings the Bible package to a meeting, and Ray Burke tells him, "No, what are you doing? That's stupid. Now's not the time to read that." So at the very end of the movie, when Eric has fired Ray, and I guess that he is going to be represented by Sam at that point, Sam picks up the package, opens it up, and starts to read the book within. It is it's a book called The Revolt of the Black Athlete, and it's written by a guy named Harry Edwards. And if you remember this at the end of the movie, Jared, the last thing we see Andre Holland's character do is he goes into a boardroom to meet with someone he calls Dr. Edwards.
Mm.
And he's going to meet with the Harry Edwards who wrote the book, The Revolt of the Black Athlete.
Huh. It's interesting.
Yeah, this is where one of my criticisms comes in into this story. So I'm going to read from refinery29.com, which has a really good write-up titled "How High Flying Bird's Final Scene Illuminates the Entire Movie."
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about Harry Edwards' book, High Flying Bird. So his book, The Revolt of the Black Athlete, is about the system of inequality behind professional sports. So this is a quote in the Refinery 29 piece. Edwards peels off the covers and exposes the myth of fair play and esprit de corps in a sport, in sports, as a giant trap for black athletes who have been charmed from without and strangled from within. This is the journalist Samuel J. Skinner in the foreword to the book. And Edwards goes on to propose an alternative. According to Tambe Obenson of IndieWire, The Revolt of the Black Athlete is a treatise on how the collective voices and concerted actions of black athletes could evoke institutional change. So apparently Edwards was an organizer for the Olympic Project for Human Rights, which was aimed at encouraging black athletes to boycott the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City. And this group had these five demands. They wanted Muhammad Ali's title restored, which had been stripped from him because he refused to fight in Vietnam. They wanted the apartheid states of South Africa and Rhodesia to be disinvited from the game. And the third one, according to Refinery 29, is that they wanted more black coaches hired. So eventually the International Olympic Committee does ban Rhodesia and South Africa. And that kind of takes the wind out of the boycott. But the athletes who go to compete who are black use this as an opportunity to have a platform to speak about these issues. And so you probably know this picture. After the men's 200-meter race, Tommy Smith and John Carlos are on the medal stand, and they both raise their hands in a fist salute, signifying black power.
Yeah.
All that comes out of this 1968 Olympics environment. So when they do that, Smith and Carlos are expelled from Olympic Village. They're dismissed from the game. The media blows up on them. You know, they face decades of death threats. But eventually the Obama administration celebrates them in 2016.
Mm.
So this is the perspective that is at the heart of the book identified as the Bible of High Flying Bird.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mechanism for redemption, that black athletes through revolutionary means would seize the economic power of professional sports. Jared, what about glorification? What is glorification in the world of High Flying Bird?
I guess when that happens.
Yeah. So what we find out at the end of the movie is that by pulling every string possible, right, he's you know, speaking with the player's representation. He's speaking with player agents and parents. He's speaking with ownership representatives, that Andre Holland's character, Ray, has basically brought the lockout to an end. And it appears that he's going to get a promotion at work. And, you know, it looked like things were dire for him because he'd been fired, and his boss was telling him, like, you've almost lost this client for us. And you think he's going to be fired, but Ray eventually tells him, no, actually, I'm going up on the top floor. And it looks like he's climbing the career ladder through this choice. Anything else we need to add to that worldview breakdown?
I think that's it, buddy, for right now.
All right, so then we'll get into our analysis questions. The first is, what's the story and get it right? We hope we just did that through the worldview analysis. The second is, where am I? And we're told to see the style and shape of the imaginary world. So where are you in High Flying Bird, Jared Moore?
Well, movies like this are difficult because the director wants me to be the white owner.
Hmm.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's not who I see myself as.
Why do you think he wants you to be the white owner?
Because there's a specific narrative here presented. I mean, there are also white players being locked out, but there's no mention of them. This is a black versus white systemic argument, in my opinion. And so because of that narrative, like the emphasis on the black athlete and the Bible thing that you just summarized, man, what about the white athletes who are not owners either?
Or the Hispanic, or the Asian, or the Greek. Yeah. Or Middle Eastern. I mean, the NBA is incredibly diverse.
Oh, yeah. And not only that, but I mean, the what I know about business owners, they've got the most on the line.
If you don't mind, before we do that, can we save that for what's distorted evil and false? How do we subvert idolatry?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. So you don't think this movie is asking you to identify with the plight of Eric or the other athletes who are being locked out?
I don't think so.
See, I would say it does. It wants me, of course, like you just said, I'm not really represented in the primary members of the cast unless it's the evil white guy who represents the owners.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this movie wants me to see what Ray Burke is attempting on behalf of Eric Scott and other players like him as good, noble, and upright.
Mm-hmm.
I don't follow it. I don't think it is able to persuade me to do that, but I do think that's what it wants me to do. All right, Jared. So what about question three? What's good, true, and awesome here? Behold common grace.
Again, just what we said about creation.
Uh-huh.
I guess that and then the uniqueness of how everything was shot. I mean, it's impressive. You know, I had no idea it was an iPhone, you know?
Yeah, yeah. He's a skilled movie maker. He's a skilled storyteller.
He is. It's frustrating when when I disagree with the narrative.
Yeah.
And when the narrative is, it's lopsided,
sure.
You know, like, I mean, it's obviously lopsided in that league.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not talking about hockey, you know, like
Jared, I think I hear you complaining about being underrepresented in this movie.
Well, I'm not complaining. I'm just like, I mean, can you imagine?
Are you looking for cinematic justice, Jared?
I'm not at all. But can you imagine doing this same exact movie, but making it about white middle class versus white rich, or you know what I'm saying? Like,
Frank Kaminsky, who is I think still in the Charlotte Bobcats, you know, a white bred Midwest player versus Michael Jordan, the black owner. I cannot imagine that. I don't think that movie gets made. But we are talking about what's good, true, and awesome here. Can I tell you what I think is actually good that this movie gets right?
Sure.
Athletes should try to maximize their market value.
Okay.
That's a good thing.
That's capitalism.
Exactly. Exactly. That is the best aim that they can bring to the market. And guess what? God wants them to. That's why he gave us the concepts of private property, thou shalt not steal, and not just mm-hmm. thou shalt not steal, but thou shalt not even covet. So it's a good thing for Eric and Andre and everybody involved to try to get the most return on the product or skill they bring to the market. That's a really good thing.
Mm-hmm. And that's what that was in the back of my mind in this movie, was the capitalism that it's arguing for and doesn't even know it probably.
Well, and so we've been chomping at the bit to get to this. I think it's probably where we're most interested in this movie. Question four, what's distorted evil and false? How can I subvert idolatry? Do you want to start off there? Because I think there's a lot.
I think the narrative is, it's distorted evil and false. It is one-sided, only presents what fits into the narrative they want to tell instead of the reality of it, that there's all kinds of races. So this can't be a white-black thing. There's all kinds of races that are being locked out as well. And
participating in the lockout. Locking the players out. Yeah. So there's a lot in this movie that I think is distorted, evil, and false. But the one that grates on me the most is how warped and simplistic the economic perspective of this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be so insightful. And this is beneath junior high level understandings of economics. But anyway, I'm trying to say that in support of you, not cut you off, although I've done so. So carry on.
Yeah, I mean that's the first thing. All right. Do you have anything to add to that on the first thing?
Well, I want to elaborate on the story. If you'll give me just a second to elaborate on it.
Sure.
We have virtually lost economic understanding in this country on a popular level, and we've specifically lost that economics is a moral issue as Christians, and that when we're talking about the moral, you know, aspects of economics, we are specifically not talking about a socialistic approach to the natural world and the scarce resources it offers.
Mm-hmm.
We're so confused on this that Tim Keller will put an op-ed in the New York newspapers about going to find faithful Christians who are participating in socialism. Well, they may be believers. I'm not going to challenge that. But socialism is a deeply unchristian economic system.
Mm-hmm.
It violates two explicit commandments of the Ten Commandments, and it violates generally the ethos of the Bible's economic perspective. So this is not a matter of ambiguity or something that is not clear. The Bible is very clear about me having private property, maximizing it efficiently, and reaping the rewards or suffering the consequences of doing that well or poorly.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate how generous you're being with me on this. But, you know, what we call today economic justice, the Bible is very interested in it. The Bible is very interested. God is very interested in seeing to it that the poor are not oppressed or taken advantage of, right?
Right.
Or that the rich aren't favored socially.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But the way we do economic justice is antithetical to the way the Bible does economic justice. So what we want to do is control outcome. And what I mean by outcome is we want to control how much someone is paid, regardless of the value that they bring to the marketplace in terms of skill or product.
Mm-hmm.
So we say we have to set a minimum wage law. So the lowest that anybody can be paid in their state or whatever is $9.35. That is not economic justice. Mm-hmm. It's not good for the poor. And it doesn't look anything like the way the Bible seeks to empower the poor and bring economic justice. If you go look at the prophets, you don't see God saying, I'm going to set the price of a bushel of wheat at X number denarii. What you see him saying is, I will judge the man who uses unjust scales. Make sense?
Yeah, still, yeah.
And so what God is interested in doing is seeing to it that there is fair competition in the marketplace, that the person bringing the product to the marketplace is not disadvantaged in getting the maximum return on his product, and the person buying the product is not disadvantaged in him getting the maximum return on the price he pays for the product he desires.
Mm-hmm.
So God says just scales, not set wages. Does that make sense?
It does.
And even if you go look at Israel's relief system, there was a form of economic relief built into Israel's society. It was not just charity or some kind of government redistribution of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
It was largely built on the obligation and charity of landowners to leave unharvested areas of their fields so that poor people could come and harvest through their own labor, their own maximizing their return on harvesting this crop, mm-hmm. and therefore find dignity in the work done and be able to participate in the market.
Mm-hmm.
John Locke, who is no Christian, scholar, he has this great proposal. He says, if we think of the world as it was originally created, and let's say there's 15 people running around in it, and somewhere over in North America, there's an acorn tree and it's dropping acorns on the ground. To whom do those acorns belong? And he mm-hmm. rightly says it's the person who goes and gathers them up mm-hmm. and puts them to profitable use. That's basically the financial relief system of Israel. Only the landowner is called to be charitable. Nobody comes with a sword and says, give me a percentage of your wealth so I can go do with it what I think is right. In fact, God warns the nation of Israel that should they choose a king, God warns them, he is going to come and take as much from you as I do in mm-hmm. the tithe. And then he's going to want your children to fight in his wars and things like that. So again, this movie is warped and simplistic. At one point, Ray tells Spence, there's more mouths to be fed, meaning that therefore players should get more share of the revenue. That is outcome fixing. That is not maximizing the competitive return on investment that God creates in the Old Testament law, and that reflects his justice, his economic justice.
Hmm.
I've went for a while there. Feel free to to say some stuff.
No, I think you're right on all that, man. The second thing that I'd like to bring up is that the owners are basically presented as the bad guys here, but the owners of a business or a team have the most to lose. Like, they have the most skin in the game, you know, the most, the most danger there. And I think there's this assumption that, oh, the owners, you know, they're rich, wealthy, and
privileged.
They don't deserve X, Y, or Z. And there's this assumption that if someone is rich, there's also this assumption that if they've inherited it, that it's somehow
wicked
yeah. Or, but I mean, dude, I mean, what athlete did not inherit these God-given, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, yes, they perfect it, but athleticism,
they maximize the return on their giftedness. I mean,
yes, they did. But what I'm saying is, you can't be mad at this dude who inherited something when you did not create your you know. I mean, it's not like I can go out and be LeBron James. I mean, most of this is things that they're born with. I mean, if you're going to disparage someone who inherited something when you have inherited your giftedness. And I mean, I know that's not apples to apples, but they are similar. I don't think you can disparage one without disparaging the other.
Well, can I go further than that?
Sure.
God, again, created the concept of private property.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept of private property necessitates that I am able to disperse my private property as I see fit upon my death. Mm-hmm. And that it is not immoral to do so.
Right.
So if I use my private property to say, I'm going to just bless this person, it could be my offspring, or it could be a charitable organization, or it could be someone that I've never, you know, I have no genetic relationship to, but I've come to admire, or an institution like a church, or, you know, some think tank.
Sure.
Private property, my God-given right to private property necessitates that choice be mine to make. And that, you know, as people who understand that God has made this system, that we say it is just and upright for someone to get to do with their private property what is not otherwise forbidden by Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that inheritance is somehow immoral, which I think is very much part of the political and economic delusions we're suffering right now, is completely false. I realize there are people who are born on third base and thought they hit a triple. That doesn't mean that inheritance somehow necessarily makes you a wicked, privileged person.
Right.
And again, I hope that these players who have this incredible earning potential will maximize their return on that and maybe someday become owners themselves.
Yeah. So they have, I think they will.
Well, Michael Jordan has, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we know that LeBron James is going to retire as a billionaire. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
And their ESPN reported just this week that they, you know, their investigative reporting indicates that they think he wants to become an owner pretty soon after he leaves his playing career behind. You know what, man? That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I celebrate that. And I don't think he's a bad guy if that's what happens. And you know what? He's not going to be a bad guy if he turns around and leaves his inheritance to Bronny and his children.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to be bad people for receiving that inheritance.
Right.
So with this movie, the just perspective is to expect every party involved to compete for their best interests. And that's what's going to maximize the scarce resources. So I expect for the athletes to try to get as much of the revenue from the partnership they have with these owners as they can.
Yep.
I expect the owners to try to get as much of the revenue from the partnership they have with these players for their own interests. And I expect the third party that this film has no reference to, the fans who buy tickets and merchandise and watch the ads that fund these things, to compete as they're able to for the lowest ticket prices and whatnot. so that they get the best return on their spending dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And when these things happen, there is a natural stasis that develops where, again, scarce resources are maximized.
Yeah.
A buddy of mine who is a pastor in the PCA church is the first guy who kind of helped me think through economics as a Christian. And he said, for Christians, we see selling a product on the market or a skill in the market as service, so that the person I'm in this business transaction with is glad to give me their dollar because they value the product or the skill I'm exchanging for that dollar more than they value their dollar.
Mm-hmm.
That is how the quality of life is raised, and that is how wealth is created. And I expect the players and the owners and the fans to all work in competitive balance to maximize scarce resources, be that athletic prowess or the opportunity to enjoy the multi-sensory experience of a professional athletic competition. And the fact that this movie sides with just one of them as if they're the oppressed minority with no reference to other interests that are just is really frustrating to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're right. So if we play a thought experiment, you're right. The athletes bring skill and risk to the table,
mm-hmm.
right? So they have a skill. People like myself want to pay to watch them do basketball. They also bring risk. They could hurt themselves catastrophically and lose their earning power. Owners bring resources and risk to the table as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes municipalities get stupid and don't do this, but they bring the risk of creating structures like practice facilities and arenas, investing capital in, creating those structures, hoping that there will be a return on that investment through, holding events like basketball games.
Mm-hmm.
And if something goes sideways, they're out the money they've laid out in that investment.
Yep.
So both parties are bringing resources and risk to the table. And neither one of them is more morally upright in the arrangement.
Right.
So I'm on a soapbox, but this movie just, it just crawled all over me.
Well, it had an agenda or a story it wanted to tell, and it just tried to force everything square pegs into round holes. I mean, it bothers me, I guess, because it didn't desire to tell the true story. I guess that's what bothers, because it's supposed to be loosely a this is reality, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not.
Right. And again, this is reflective of our societal delusion. You want to talk about an idol. The idol of our age is that the worker is always the oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And like somehow they're immune to greed, and that their claims against the employer or the people who are wealthier than they are, that's totally immune to wicked covetousness.
Yeah.
I look at our age and I just see greed enthroned and exalted. Yeah. Now, do I deny that there are greedy wealthy people? Not at all. I just also know there are greedy poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's greedy people in the middle. It's frustrating.
Yeah. It is frustrating.
You know, LeBron James himself, not too long ago he made headlines for saying that NFL owners have a slave owner mentality, and it is just so divorced from reality. They have a brand that they want to maximize the return on, and so they want to make certain choices about how that brand is presented nationally. And LeBron sees that as slave ownership. I'm not a black man. I can't help but think that black men who are actually enslaved would see that as even more ludicrous than I do.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because these athletes are empowered not only to make a return on their skill, but they're empowered to have a voice in a way that lets LeBron say, I think you people are acting like slave owners. I mean, mm-hmm. LeBron is the face of player empowerment. He has moved about the league and moved other players about the league willy-nilly. Often mm-hmm. against their will, because he wants to win championships. Is it just to accuse him of having a slave owner's mentality?
Hmm.
Just the other day, after the trade deadline in the NBA, which happened not too long before this recording, Brandon Ingram and JaVale McGee, who are LeBron's teammates, the fans of the Indiana Pacers were chanting at them. They chanted, "LeBron's going to trade you," at Brandon Ingram. And they chanted at JaVale McGee, "Not good enough to be traded."
Oh, wow.
All of that's there because everyone knows that LeBron is the guy who controls those players' destinies.
Mm-hmm.
Can we justly say he has a slave owner's mentality? I think there'd be uproar if we did, but apparently he's free to level that accusation at people who own the Dallas Cowboys or the Tennessee Titans or whatever. I don't know what team he was upset with, but you know, he's willing to shoot that gun at them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it's time to quit talking about economics, but the economics in this are bad. They're sinful. They're wicked and they're idolatrous, and Christians should reject them.
I'm sorry, man. I want to record that last little rant, and use it for your ringtone.
You should. Hey,
the economics. Say it again. The economics in this movie are bad, sinful, should be rejected, wicked,
idolatrous.
That's pretty good. You just come up with that. Like, that's not written down.
That should be on the poster for this movie. Hey, in all seriousness, if our listeners think I'm crazy or they are provoked and they say, "Hey, you know what? I've not really thought much about economics as a Christian," go get Economic Shalom by John Bolt. The subtitle for that is A Reform Primer on Faith, Work, and Human Flourishing. Or go get the Ligonier series by R.C. Sproul Jr. It is on economics. It is called, one second and I will figure that out. It's a great study, and it's got a compelling visual component, and you can order it from Ligonier. It's awesome. They often put it up in their $5 Friday, and it's called Economics for Everybody. It's great. Mm. Go track those down. You should read those as part of your Christian discipleship if you're not familiar with how Christians view economics in terms of managing scarce resources to God's glory.
Yeah, it's very thought-provoking, buddy.
Last thing that I also have a gripe with, the vision of Christianity in this movie is really awful. Did you pick up on that?
Mm-mm.
So there's a player that is on the same NBA team as Eric, but they're in this social media war, and that other player is managed by his mom. And so Andre Holland's character goes to meet with her, and he quotes the Bible to her, and she says, "Oh, yes, the prosperity gospel. Amen." And she regularly repeats basically prosperity gospel nonsense throughout the course of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then Spence, who runs the gym, if anybody mentions slavery to him, he insists that they say, "I love the Lord and all his black people." And so you've got prosperity gospel and black liberation theology.
Mm-hmm.
Just bad systems that do not reflect the scope of God's word and the beauty thereof.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Last question. Any idols you see here we haven't touched on?
No, I think you nailed them, man.
Well, I got one more. Just the idol of assuming that my ingenuity and my cleverness, my maximizing my economic value, those are the chief indicators of my future and what's going to happen with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I would push back on that and say, it's a good thing for you to use to leverage your ingenuity and your cleverness. It's a good thing for you to maximize your economic value at any moment, but it is not ultimately determinative of your fate or destiny.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally got to question number 5. How does the gospel apply?
Would you say that the telos is how the gospel applies, like what the end goal is, how it is freeing? Like, you're talking about maximizing your earning potential, or for the scarce resources, which is what we should do. But the end goal is God's glory.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens if I don't maximize, or if I'm in a system, right? Let's say this system is legit, that it exists. What if I'm in a system like that? What do I do? Or how do I, like, the way that these, from what I understand, these players are under contract, like they have an obligation to the owners, right? Like as employees.
Yes. But those contracts also obligate the owners to them as employers in certain ways.
Right, right. And so they figured out a kind of a loophole, right, to make money outside of that contract.
Yes. Or at least threatened to.
Yeah, at least threatened to. Yeah, my understanding as far as how the gospel applies would be that, Christ winning the ultimate battle for us, right, that matters, frees us to be in systems that are, I don't want to say oppressive, but...
We haven't capitalized on all of our potentials, sure, or resources.
I mean, you know as well as I do, dude, that there is this, you may not feel it, but I feel it. There's this pressure in even pastoring to, you know, like you were talking about earlier in this episode about trying to, you know, church growth and all those things and the definition of success, the worldly definition and, any church you've pastored or I've pastored, there are folks that leave that blows your mind, and you don't know why you don't understand. And, but I mean, and that can mess with you, like mess with your calling, your, should I be doing this? All that stuff. But something that this movie misses is that, it's all about winning and all about being outside of this system that they believe is oppressing them. And look, if you're in a system like that, I think you should work and labor to try to be out of it, if it really is a system like that. But what if you can't? What if you're stuck? What if you are maximizing your resources and your potential, but your aspirations are higher than what you're capable of? The gospel frees you because the ultimate battle has been won by Christ and given to you. You know, it's been given to us as if we have conquered sin and death and the grave eternally.
Right. We have a great benefactor who has profited us apart from our anything we brought to the table.
Right, and it's very freeing. And not only that, but what, and so we bring nothing to the table, but what's amazing about being united to Christ by the Holy Spirit is that He is, spiritually, we are the righteousness of God, is how Paul says it in 2 Corinthians, I believe it's in chapter 5, verse 20 and 21. I may be wrong, but I know it's in chapter 5 of 2 Corinthians. And so there's this reality where He is making us righteous like Christ, and one day we will be. One day we will deserve to be in heaven because of the work that has been not only given to us, but has, in a sense, become us. And it really is a remarkable thing. Think of the new bodies that we get, and how sin, like when we deserve to be there because of what Christ has accomplished for us. It's all because of what He's accomplished and done. But there's this, I mean, it's really, it just blows my mind because when we were God's enemies, He loved us through Christ. But then by the time we get to the new heavens and new earth, He's loving us. Like there's actually something lovable about us now, mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm with you there. I just want to remind, sort of a supplement, that our dignity, even as people who should be competitive economic actors, our dignity is not even found in maximizing our economic interests. It's in the image of God, and our ultimate destiny isn't controlled by our wit, again, our cleverness, our ingenuity, our empowerment. Our destiny is ultimately determined by who our shepherd is. And what should it profit a man if he gained all of the collectively bargained agreement revenue of a major sports league and lose his soul? That's not a question that revolutionary ideology or economic theory The state of your soul can't be addressed with those things. They can reflect them, but they can't be addressed by them. And so even if, Andre Holland's character gains the whole world through his negotiations, we just have to remember that as important as those things may be, they're not ultimately determinative of eternal destiny. So that's me supplementing what I thought was a good explanation on your part about the gospel.
Yeah, amen, buddy. Amen. I find it freeing. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to think about being a preacher versus these NBA guys.
Well, truthfully, I think that's the root cause of a lot of the economic delusions we're in. We have a tendency as fallen human beings to compare ourselves against those who have what we see as an advantage over us.
Yeah.
We're far less likely to compare ourselves with those who we have a better situation in comparison to.
Yeah. And it's similar to taxes, right?
Oh yeah.
The rich got to pay their fair share. And like you see these jokers saying 70% tax rate on the rich. And I'm like, come on, let me go take 70% of your income and, yeah. And give it to somebody else. Oh, I'm the government, so it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, man.
Hey, dude, let's put our government hats on and go steal 70% of people's money and just give it away to people.
Yeah, but we live in a world where that's described as justice or, integrity.
Robin Hood. The government ain't Robin Hood. They're the thief that's sneaking in the window at night.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you go, the Robin Hood stories are misrepresented. The rich he stole from were the overburdening government officials. Yeah. So anyway, I guess we've been around this mulberry bush enough. Anything we got left to say about High Flying Bird?
I don't think so. How many, for fun, what rating would you give this out of 10?
Just as a movie, like without having to evaluate the messaging, I thought it was a 5 as just telling me the story it wants to tell me.
Mm-hmm.
If I factor in the credibility of the proposed morality of this movie, mm-hmm. I would have a hard time giving it a 1.
Yeah.
It's an immoral movie. That's the thing. We don't think about economic realities in those terms, but this is an immoral movie. We should think about it that way.
Mm.
And for me, it's not even racial dynamics. Long before we get to racial dynamics, it's just a matter of what we assume about other people who are in a competitive environment with us in terms of our economic advantages and risks.
Mm-hmm. Because you're saying it's saying only the NBA players, only the black NBA players in this movie should be able to maximize their earning potential.
Right. One party is arbitrarily favored. And again, in the Bible, that would be unjust scales.
Yeah.
God's against it.
Yeah.
So that's the last I'm going to say, I promise. You got anything else to say on this movie?
No, that's it, man.
All right. Well, Jared, where can people find you outside the world of our podcast?
You can find me at Jared H. Moore on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook at All Truth is God's Truth. I've got another podcast with some episodes on there, so check that out. And you can find some of my articles on the Monergism blog. Check those out as well. What about you, brother?
I'm at Right Jeff on most social media platforms. One thing I was going to pitch to our listeners that I don't often talk about is that I am on a movie review site called Letterboxd, and I would love to talk to you via Letterboxd. So it's letterbox and then just a D, letterboxd.com. If you're not familiar, you can find me again, / Right Jeff. You'll see the movies I'm watching. You'll see my general thoughts on that, whatever that film is. And I'd love to connect with you on Letterboxd. So letterboxd.com, Right Jeff. And otherwise, pick a social media platform. I'm probably on it at Right Jeff. You can reach the podcast at PCCDpod on most social media platforms as well. You can reach out to us by email through PCCDpod@gmail.com. And we would specifically love to have you join us in our Facebook group, the Pop Culture Coram Deo Podcast Perpetual After Party. That is a long name, but a great group. And if you go to our Facebook page, which again, facebook.com/PCCDpod, you'll see a big blue button that says Visit Group. That'll take you to that group. Jump in there and Let's keep the conversation going. We'd also like to ask you if you're willing to go to iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you're getting this episode, and leave us a 5-star review or whatever review you feel comfortable leaving for us. It helps us know how to better tailor the podcast to serve the church. We hope this is useful to the church, and we want to aim our efforts at that. So those reviews help us. They also help other people who may be interested in the podcast find us. So if you'd leave us one of those reviews, we would be much appreciative. Jared, what do you want to watch next time, buddy?
I want to check out The Battle Angel.
Alita, how about you do that as like, you know, our designated reporter, and you come back and tell me how good it is. How about
you
that?
You might love it, man. You might love it.
I guess. I think there's a more likely outcome.
It'd be better than this movie.
It would be. It would probably be better than How to Train Your Dragon as well. I know that's going to be a controversial take, but not a fan of those movies. Yeah, I guess I'll do that, man, but gosh, that's rough. We need to get to March. I need to see Captain Marvel, get to April and see Shazam. We need some of that good stuff.
Yes, we do. Us.
Avengers Endgame. So,
oh, man, yes.
Good things
are
ahead
of us.
All right, so we'll plan on seeing Alita Battle Angel. Alita the Frog-Eyed. Guys, if you want to watch that, get out ahead of it. We'll join you for that conversation, Lord willing, on the next episode of the Pop Culture Cormdale podcast. For Jared Moore, I'm Jeff Wright, reminding you to live every moment as if you are before the face of God, because you are. We'll talk to you next time.